Welcome to History Lessons, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast featuring the world's leading historians answering the big questions, hosted by Matthias Hesseris.
Hello. According to the New York Times, an estimated 40,000 books about JFK have been published since his death. I'll repeat that. 40,000 books. Today I'm joined by Frederick Logewell, Lawrence D. Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School and Professor of History at Harvard University. Logewell is also the author of a new biography on Kennedy, simply called JFK, which is the first volume of two covering the period 1917 to 1956. We will discuss Kennedy the man and the politician and why we need yet another biography on JFK. Fred, let's start with why you chose to embark on this massive project. Why did you feel there was a need for a new biography on John F. Kennedy?
Well, I think, Matthias, that as you point out, the literature is enormous on this man. So it's a really fair question. But I think there's something kind of curious about this literature. Because though we have endless numbers of books on his presidency, on Kennedy's administration, on his family, on his marriage, what we don't really have, and I don't have a good explanation for this, by the way, is what I would consider to be a comprehensive, a kind of full-fledged life and times biography. And so I thought, you know, we need that. The materials, the archival materials are phenomenal. I'm in a good position because the Kennedy Library in particular is just down the road from me. This is the time to do this. And so I decided to embark on this project.
So let's discuss Kennedy the man. And first, let's set the stage. And what a magnificent stage it is. So if you could tell me briefly of the world JFK is born into and the Kennedy clan.
Yeah, so he's born 1917, just as the United States is entering World War I, which I think is significant, by the way. I suggest in the book that it's really the dawn of the American century, at least as I define that century. And in fact, another reason why I think I decided to pursue this book is I thought, you know, I can tell the story of Kennedy, but I can also tell the story of America, and indeed of the world in terms of foreign affairs, at least, in this half century in which he lived. So he's born in Boston, or suburban Boston, in 1917, to what will become a very large Irish Catholic family. His father will make an absolute fortune. In fact, they'll become one of the richest families in America before Joe Kennedy is done. And it's a, how should I put it? It's a striving family. Jack is the second of nine children. Joe Jr. is the oldest, and then comes John or Jack. And, you know, the father in particular, to some extent the mother, Rose, but maybe Joe in particular, feels that whatever he does, however much success he has in the business world, and it's phenomenal, including, by the way, in a stint in Hollywood, he'll never be fully accepted. There's a chip on his shoulder that I think, to some degree, he passes to his kids. The kids don't experience the kind of discrimination that he has felt all his life, and probably has exaggerated in some ways. But I think even young Jack, when he's at Harvard as an undergraduate, knows that as a Catholic, as an Irish Catholic, there are certain doors that will be closed for him. And I do think it affects young Jack as he matures, that he's of this background. And that Irish background, the Catholicism, mm-hmm. I think it matters. And I trace that in various ways in the book.
Can you tell me about the relationship between Jack and Joe Jr. growing up? Because this is interesting. He's being the second born here, and they have a strong relationship to the father as well. But tell me about Jack and Joe then.
You know, I found this so interesting, Matthias, to write about, because I knew something about this sibling relationship. And of course, there's a rivalry, as there often is. One of the things that I found interesting is that I think the rivalry is stronger from Joe's side, Joe Jr.'s side, than from Jack's. Because there is an expectation by everybody, not least the parents, that Joe Jr. is the one who's destined for greatness. I think he feels that pressure, maybe in a way that Jack
does. Even from the very beginning, it's from his birth. Yes. So he's the one who's supposed to be the president.
Yes, and in fact, his grandfather, basically on the day of his birth, basically says, half jokingly, but only half, his grandfather, who's a prominent Boston politician himself, Honey Fitzgerald, says this is the future president of the United States. And I think Joe grows up with that notion. He's also strikingly handsome. He's strong. He's athletic. He's smart in a certain way, but doesn't have the kind of imaginative intelligence that I think his younger brother has. But that relationship between the two of them is an important theme in the book. And as Jack begins to have successes, his senior thesis is published as a book. He has a heroic turn in the South Pacific during the war. I think Joe Jr. more and more feels that he's being outshined by his brother. And I think it wears on him. I think it's a hard thing for him to fully, what's the word, accept. And he goes to his death in 1944 in the Second World War in a kind of, I don't know what to call it, a suicide mission, really. Mm. Goes to his death still on some level wanting to match his brother, maybe ideally try to go further than his brother. And arguably, I can only speculate about this, it might even contribute to his decision to volunteer for that final fatal mission.
What role does Joe Kennedy, the father, play in this relationship? And does he play them against each other? Does he sort of try to keep the competition up? Or what does it look like?
Yeah, I think he does not shy away from... on some level, I think he does play up the rivalry between the brothers. He thinks it's healthy for both of them. And he'll say, you know, Joe, Jack is practicing the piano a lot more than you are. Or Jack, you know, Joe is hitting the books. What are you doing? So I think he wants to stoke that when they fight, as brothers will do, on the living room floor, he does nothing to intervene. He wants them to fight it out. He, at the same time, I think Joe Sr. feels, as we've been saying, that Joe, his namesake, is the one who is destined for greatness. Hmm. And he wants, in particular, I think, to build up Joe. It doesn't mean that he doesn't see promise in Jack, but it's never like he sees it in Joe. And I think that is something that both brothers perceive. They see that in some ways Joe is the favorite of his father. Hmm. And I wondered when I was doing the research, was this hard for Jack? And on some level, I think it was. But it also, I suggest in the book, it gave him a certain comfort in the sense that he didn't have to try to compete in the same way. He could cultivate his interest in reading. He could be a little bit of a slacker in school. Hmm. Didn't have to apply himself quite as much. And in some way, I think it worked to his benefit.
Can you tell us a little bit about the sources here? Because they're quite good. There's a lot of material, so you can really get a sense of what the relationship looks like.
Yeah, you know, I mean, this is something I thought going in would be great. That is to say, the archival material. But Matthias, it is incomparably better even than I imagined. Just down the street from where I'm sitting today, so I'm in Cambridge. But at the Kennedy Library is a set of materials that is just incredible. And especially maybe for the period that we're discussing now, the Kennedy family began keeping a voluminous correspondence in really the early 1930s. And it went through, I would say, the end of World War II. So you're talking about 13, 14, 15 years in which there are hundreds and hundreds of letters from the parents to the kids, from the kids back to the parents, from siblings, you know, to one another, Jack writing to his friends, in particular his best friend, Lem Billings. It's an extraordinary collection, And it's now basically fully open. Anybody can go in. Mm. Some of it is digitized, but most of it you actually have to go to the library. But I did not anticipate just how rich this material would be. One other thing, which is that Jack, on his travels, and we'll talk a little bit about this, I'm sure, keeps a diary on many of these travels. Mm-hmm. Those diaries are also available. So, yeah, the materials are really rich.
Joe Jr. and Jack are obviously trained to become leaders. What did that leadership training look like?
Well, first off, I think, and I commend the parents for this. They're a complicated pair, Joe and Rose, for reasons that, you know, we can go into. But I think that they did instill in their kids from an early age the notion of public service. You've got to believe in something greater than yourself. Mm. And even though the family became fabulously wealthy, I don't think that instruction ever went away. I think that was something that they really pressed. And I think the kids, all of them, internalized this, accepted this. You know, they could have been, you know, rich playboys, the sons. And the girls could have also pursued lives of leisure. But they didn't. And so I think it's that. I think it's also a sense imparted by both parents, and in some ways maybe more Rose, as I think about it, than Joe, that you, Joe Jr., and you, Jack, can be leaders. You can pursue perhaps governmental service, and this was something in particular that Joe Jr. was intent on doing. But you've got what it takes. You can be as good as anybody else. You may be Catholic. You may be of Irish descent. But these Harvard boys that you're going to university with, you know, they're no better than you are. And you can do this. And then finally, I would say, a growing realization on their part. And of course, Jack is the one that I'm most familiar with here. But I think he gained confidence in the all-important, shall we say, late 30s through the end of World War II, a very important part of his life, a very important phase, confidence that, yes, you know, I can pursue a political career and, in fact, reach quite far in this. I think it's a combination of those things that I think formed this basis for leadership.
Let's go back for a moment just to this idea of public service, because I think it's something that probably is a little bit lost today, and it's also hard to imagine how strong that notion can be. So it's one of those things that you really need to understand this sort of historical context to grasp what this idea of public service means. And I think it coincides with also America entering onto the world stage as the leader. So, I mean, basically, JFK growing up follows that trajectory of America taking over from the old world. In terms of when they speak about public service, what context do they relate to? In terms of their friends and the environment they're in, is this something that is an accepted concept for everyone?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I do think if it's not accepted by everyone, it's certainly a broadly held view among young people of their station. They're, of course, part of a very privileged group, a sort of subset of U.S. society, given their father's immense wealth, given the fact that they go to, you know, fancy prep schools, they go to Choate, the older boys, and then to Harvard. I do think it's broadly accepted that this is an exciting
sort of
time
for them. Noblesse oblige kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it is, and there's also a sense that the United States is a rising power. Mm. That the United States, even if it's still a kind of junior member of the great power club, it's rising fast. And because I don't know how much they were, you know, directly aware of this, but I think they had a sense that because of its demographic advantages and geographic advantages, the United States was probably destined to become the greatest power of them all before too long. This was a very exciting time. They could be part of this. They could help shape this future. Mm. I think both boys felt this, and I think the circles in which they traveled, their friends at Choate, their friends at Harvard, many of them I think felt the same. And I think what you suggest, Matthias, is it's a little harder for us today to see this, and which is in some ways maybe a shame. Mm. And you wonder if young people today of their means and of their age feel it in quite the same way.
There's something here. I mean, today we talk a lot about, for example, young people talk about they want to become a change maker or something like that. But there's something different there because it's so abstract. Well, this is quite concrete. It's really taking, you know, serving your country, going into politics, working within the system in many ways. That's basically what I take from this when I read your book. But what is also so striking, coming back to the privilege, is how easy everything at least seems. You can choose between Princeton and Harvard or wherever you want to go. You can take a gap year. If you want to see the Pope, you see the Pope. How would you describe JFK's character during those early years?
It's really true. I mean, I had great fun, I will tell you, writing the chapters that basically begin with Joe Sr.'s appointment as ambassador to Great Britain and then through the end of the war. Because as you say, JFK, or as you imply, Jack becomes a kind of zealot figure in the sense that he is, it seems, everywhere, meeting with everyone. That's in part substantially because of his father's connections, his father's efforts on his behalf. I commend Joe Sr., by the way, for the degree to which, with all the kids, but especially the boys, he was willing to go to the nth degree, even though he was a very busy man, to make these kinds of connections and to make sure that Joe and Jack in particular got a chance to interact with movers and shakers all over the world.
So just as understand, so we all understand what happens. So Joe Sr. is appointed ambassador to Court of St. James's in London, which is a big thing. There's still a big thing to become an ambassador, but it's a particularly big thing during this era, and it's also at a very crucial moment in history. First, how did it happen?
A kind of advisor to Franklin Roosevelt. He has two lesser appointments during the New Deal in Washington, but wants something bigger. And he's donated both time and money to Roosevelt. So FDR feels a certain compulsion, I guess you could say, to do something for Joe, as FDR put it to his son. We got to do something for Joe. And Joe Kennedy makes clear that he would like to be ambassador, the most important ambassadorial posting really anywhere in the world in that era was London. That's the one he wanted. And, you know, FDR, complicated set of reasons, but he also saw a certain benefit to having Kennedy out of the country because he knew that Kennedy had his own presidential aspirations. He knew that he was an important figure in the Irish Catholic community and decided, you know what, I'm better off having Joe over there. And for more positive reasons as well, he thought that Kennedy could actually be useful and important and helpful as an ambassador to Britain. So yes, as you say, he goes over there at a critical point in 1938. The war clouds are already gathering. He's there until late 1940. I mean, you're hard-pressed, I think, to think of a more important two-year period.
Yeah.
Maybe in the 20th century for somebody to be ambassador over there, and that's when he's there.
And also, he's not just any ambassador. He's he comes in with his children and he rents a big house and he becomes a darling of the press in that sense.
Oh yeah, he does. And he has a glorious first few months. The British just lap this up and the photogenic family, Joe Kennedy's kind of forthrightness. He'll put his feet up on his desk when he's talking to British reporters. You know, he's very candid in his comments about the great affairs of the day. And Maybe not unimportantly, he's a strong supporter of Neville Chamberlain and strong supporter of the appeasement policy that the British and the French are following in those early months. Mm. Later on, this will turn into a disaster because Kennedy remains such a strong proponent of appeasement, even after Chamberlain himself, Chamberlain's government, begin to realize, well, this thing hasn't worked, and they really shift to a policy of deterrence. Kennedy will not budge, and it leads him into real trouble.
And when they're in London, also Jack comes there, and he visits, and this sort of gap year in his life becomes extraordinarily important for him later on. And he keeps a diary. So tell me about those travels and his time in London.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an unbelievable, almost an unbelievable set of experiences. And in particular, this, and gap year is a right way to think about it. He takes a leave from Harvard in what we call his junior year and travels to about a dozen countries on the eve of war, as it turns out. And in fact, I open the book with Jack in Berlin, just about a week before the German invasion of Poland. So this is now late August of 39. But all the while that he's doing this, he's, of course, taking both written notes and mental notes. He's getting a picture of a world in crisis that I think very few university students, maybe no university students, could ever hope to have. He's got a kind of unique vantage point. Because again, thanks to his father's connections, he's meeting in all these places with ambassadors, with journalists, with government officials, and it's an incredible experience that he has. And what's fascinating to me about this is that he begins little by little to separate himself from his father. His father, as I said, was unwavering in his belief that war had to be avoided. You need to make a deal with Hitler. Hitler is ultimately a kind of conventional statesman, and we can bargain with him. Mm-hmm. Jack, maybe not so much on the trip, but partly as a result of the trip, and then what he continues to read about us after he returns to Harvard for his final year, so now we're into 39-40, begins to say, no, I don't think this works. And he proves willing and able to separate himself from the old man in a way that Joe Jr. is never able to do. That's an important difference between both father and son and the two brothers.
Yeah. Because it also seems to, especially on the question of anti-Semitism, Joe Jr. Has a very different view from Jack.
He does, and I think, as I suggest in the book, it's impossible, at least for me, to avoid the conclusion that Joe Sr. is anti-Semitic. I think there's lots of evidence for this. It's a particular kind, and in some ways, maybe you'd say less overt than that you'd find from somebody like Henry Ford, for example, but it's very pernicious. Mm. And Joe Jr., we have, I guess you could say almost unfortunately, we have evidence in his letters that he writes not only to his family but to others. He's not very discreet about this. Joe Jr. has those same sentiments. Jack, at least as far as I've been able to see, does not. It's an important difference again.
And he also seems to be impacted of his trip to Germany and what he sees about what's going on.
Yeah.
A few words on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when Joe Jr. Over in actually many different instances, I think the first time is in 1934, but over a period of 6 years, 5 years, Joe Jr. travels through Germany and is enormously impressed by what he sees, by the orderliness of German society. Indeed, by the way that the Nazi government is treating undesirables, if you want to put it that way, and in fact, even speaking to the way that the Jews are discriminated against by the German government, which is, if not, you know, wholly supportive, he's at least broadly sympathetic to what's going on. And I quote a letter in which Joe Sr. says to Joe Jr., "I think your analysis is spot on." So I think father and eldest son are very much on the same page here. And by the way, I will say that in terms of Joe Jr.'s future political prospects, if he had returned from the war alive, it's an interesting counterfactual. What would have happened to him? What would have happened to Jack's career? I think that these anti-Semitic missives, which would have come to light, I have no doubt, would have caused a problem for Joe Jr.'s political rise in the years and decades after the war.
And this is also interesting then, because sometimes JFK is described as the creation of his father, of his family, but you describe him very much as his own man from quite an early age, and it becomes quite clear in how he makes up his mind and does his own analysis, but still in the confines of the family. So it's sort of like a diplomatic venture at the same time, because of course he writes this extraordinary thesis for a young man. I mean, it's. I agree with you. You write in the book that maybe not the writing is the extract. Is not particularly exciting in that sense. But for a young man to write something like "Why England Slept," as it was a title when it was published, is of course quite astonishing because he's young when he writes it.
I think that you see. You see the emergence. You know, I don't want to read too... It's easy after the fact to read too much into this kind of thing. But I tried to judge this senior thesis, which, as you say, becomes this first book. I try to judge it on its own terms. And I conclude in the book that it's an impressive piece of work. It shows, again, his capacity to make up his own mind, as you say, on the basis of the evidence that he gathered. With his father's help, to be sure, the evidence. But nevertheless, it's his own work, this book. And it becomes a kind of minor bestseller because it's published right at the time of the French defeat, 1940, when Americans all of a sudden are clamoring for an explanation of what's gone on. Here's a young Harvard grad, age 23, who offers a take on this. Why the British, this is the heart of the book, why are the British seemingly so unprepared to take on the German threat, given that they've just experienced World War I not long ago? Shouldn't they have been better prepared? That's really, in some ways, the heart of the book. And I think you're right. He's able and willing to do that, even though, again, his father is preaching a very different message. And of course, I need to give the father credit, because Joe Sr., whatever his faults, never insisted that Jack or anybody else among the kids had to follow his perspective on things. He basically said, you need to make up your own minds and I'll support you. And, Jack pursued that. Joe Jr. was never able to do it in the same way.
There's something also that I find interesting with his thesis, just given... His youth and it is a senior thesis. It's still a student who writes it, and what might be original at the time. I'm not sure if I'm right here, but it was just struck me that he puts an emphasis actually on politics here. It's the electorate. It's democracy itself that creates this kind of. It's not sort of the great man who goes in either direction. It's the relationship between parliament, the electorate, and that creates this kind of situation. Am I right in that? Is it sort of?
No, I think you're totally right about that. It's an excellent point, Matthias. That in some ways he is, blame is maybe not the right word. He's assigning responsibility to not just the leadership, or even principally the leadership, the Baldwin government and then the Chamberlain government. He is talking about the electorate, as you say. He's trying to do a kind of bottom-up analysis. He's looking at interest groups and public opinion in Britain in the middle part of the 1930s and the latter part of the 1930s, and finding that it is at least substantially responsible for this. Now, people at the time said, well, this is just a clever way, and some historians since have said, this is just a clever way of removing blame from Chamberlain and Baldwin, and therefore also his father, since he supported the prime minister. And maybe there's something to this, but I think it's also a more sophisticated argument that Kennedy wants to make, which is that, of course, leaders matter, but they operate within a certain environment. They are, to some extent, constrained, especially in democratic societies. And Chamberlain really has a pretty lousy set of options that he's pursuing. I think that's a kind of summation of the book in some ways.
The thing I can't get my head around is that Jack is obviously, he comes across as an incredibly charming and likable to most people he meets. It's just an empirical fact. You know, he's sort of popular. He gets into the clubs that his Irish peers would always barred from. And the girls, of course, love him. Yet when I read about him and read the extracts from, for example, the letters that you quote in your book, I actually find it hard to really find him sympathetic. And I think it has to do with that he treats his friends quite instrumental, which is not an, you know, it's not particularly original for the leaders in world history. And of course, his view of women wouldn't pass modern scrutiny. So, but how do you see him?
It's a really interesting point. I do say in the book, in the preface, and then I allude to this at various points later, that he could be heedless of friends, heedless of women. I think you're right. He did treat his friends instrumentally at times. He could be, what's the word, dismissive, I think, of their feelings. But it's interesting because these friends, and there's ample evidence for this, were incredibly loyal to him.
Yes.
He was also, in his own way, very loyal to them. And when they got into trouble, he stood by their side. He was often the first one there to help when there were problems. So there's that sort of complicated complicated dynamic. I think ultimately it's a sympathetic assessment that I offer in Volume 1. We'll see whether I hold to this fully in Volume 2. I think that the I guess the likability, the charm, the intelligence, the curiosity. One of the things that I really like about his personality is that he's just really interested in, curious about the world. Mm. His widow, Jackie, would talk about this after his death, that one of the things that really appealed to her about JFK was that whatever you were interested in, he would become interested in. I like that. I like his interest in politics, his belief that politics is fascinating precisely because politics matters.
And he seems to be sincere in actually liking to speak to voters.
I think so.
Yeah. And he even makes that point in 1956. You quote that, but I think it's but it comes across as sincere. So there's certainly something there. I don't know if he's a political animal or what it is, but it's strange that still after reading this magnificent, it's a really good book. It's hard to really understand what drives him.
Yeah, I mean, there is a, you know, there is an elusive quality to him. I think he's far from alone in this regard in terms of the people who've become political leaders. You can find this in, you know, other people. We could talk about De Gaulle, for example, and many other examples that come quickly to mind. There is that. And so one of my tasks in writing this biography was to see if I could penetrate, if I could get behind the kind of charming facade, if you will, and figure out what made him tick. I hope I did that. I think that the sources, to come back to the sources for a moment, they're so rich, I think richer than previous biographers have realized. I do think, and I hope at least, that we get a sense of the real JFK. I think it turns out he was more of a romantic in some ways than perhaps we've believed.
That's probably a good point, yeah.
This interest in history and in international affairs, I think, is there. I think the close-knit relationships that he had with his family, even in some ways with his mother, who had a great emotional reserve, but I think is very important in his upbringing. I hope I bring that out.
And going back to the sources, I think because you're making an excellent point there, there's a lot to learn, and it's also very sort of candid material. So. And if we look at the relationship with women, apart from Jackie, a woman that seems important to him is actually Inga Arvid, the Danish. Oh, yeah. She was Miss Denmark at the age of 16, and a quite extraordinary figure, almost like a character out of a novel or a spy movie.
Yeah.
And she seems more important to him than many of his previous affairs. But tell us who she was and also why that affair is important for any historian dealing with JFK.
Well, it's almost too incredible to believe the story of Inga Arvid. And, you know, she was, I'll say it to start with, I think she was the love of his life, at least until Jackie came along. She was, as you said, a beauty queen from a young age. She mastered several languages. She traveled the world. A very cosmopolitan figure. Anybody who met her, men and women, said she was incomparably beautiful. And they meet right before she is at this point a journalist in Washington. And she and JFK meet not long before Pearl Harbor, and they begin a torrid romance. What makes it absolutely fascinating to me is that she was a suspected Nazi spy because she had interviewed Hitler. She had spent time with the top Nazi leadership when she was a journalist for a Danish newspaper earlier in the mid-30s.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as a consequence, the FBI placed her under surveillance, and they tapped her phones. They went through her mail. They went through her apartment when she wasn't there. It's really right out of a spy thriller. And we have the transcripts of phone conversations, many of them between her and young JFK.
Hmm.
And you get a real insight into who she is, but also who he is. When he lets down his guard, when they talk about his future, she has great faith in his political possibilities, which is interesting because Joe Jr. is still alive.
Yeah.
And yet Inga is saying to Jack, you know, you can go as high as you want in politics.
Mm.
And they even sort of joke about the White House. And so I think he is deeply smitten with her. And when he breaks it off at his father's urging, because she's married at the time to someone else, she's a Protestant. She's a suspected spy. That's kind of a problematic trifecta. But after he breaks it off, I think he regrets this. He's still in love with her. When he's in the South Pacific, he writes these extraordinary letters to her that we have. I think she's really important to him. And I'll say one final thing. I think more than anything else, what Arvid does for him is to make him believe in himself. Yeah, I think she is so insistent that you, Jack, you know, the sky is the limit for you.
Mm.
I think he internalizes that in a way that is important for him later on.
In this volume, you follow JFK until 1956, and we end on a good note. I mean, normally biographies of JFK has a bad ending, and then that will probably come in volume two. But with... we end now with a young JFK in his prime, ready to take on the future. What are the most important moments in JFK's early political career, and what can we learn from them?
Well, I think you know, we have to probably mention the first campaign. So he decides to run for the House of Representatives from Massachusetts, the district that includes, by the way, Cambridge,
mm-hmm.
in 1946. And learns, I think, here some secrets that I think he will take with him right to the White House. That is to say, you see these again in subsequent campaigns. For example, he learns that he has to work really hard. And this, I think, is something that successful first-time candidates often learn, is that it requires incredible stamina, he shows it, even though we haven't talked about this today, but even though he's got these health ailments.
Yeah, I was about to, mention it, because it really goes against himself all the time, even from a young age. He's in pain.
He spends a lot of time in bed. It's where he gets his, I think, his at least partly his interest in reading and his interest in history comes from that. But I think here what's interesting is that almost in a way as an act of defiance, he basically says, not only in this campaign, but in the Senate campaign in 52, presidential campaign in 60, it's almost as if he's saying, you guys watch me. I'm not going to allow these ailments, and they're real. I'm not going to allow them to slow me down. And in fact, advisors, both at the beginning and at the end, would say he drives us to exhaustion because he's willing to go hour after hour after hour. So that's one lesson he takes. I think he also comes to realize that he's got a certain connection with voters. I think he's surprised by this, and maybe especially female voters, but not just female voters. But I think he sees in this first campaign, even though he's not a particularly good speaker yet, in fact, he's kind of a poor speaker, he's not particularly good at sort of repartee when he's at the microphone and he's going back and forth with voters or with journalists. So he's got shortcomings, but there's something about him that connects with voters. And I think he takes that from that first campaign and then builds on this. And then maybe the final thing he realizes that I'll mention here is that he needs good people around him. So his family is always involved in his campaigns, and they're a real asset, not least his mother. But he also says, I gotta have good advisors. I've gotta have good strategists with me. He'll make the ultimate decisions. By the way, another point that shows his willingness to be independent from his father is that though Joe bankrolls these campaigns, when it comes to the actual key political strategic decisions, Jack makes them, not his father.
One thing I wonder is that, because we often see JFK as a sort of the start of the sort of celebrity politician era, when politics become part of a celebrity culture in a sense. But did he actually realize that himself? Did he realize the power in good looks, the perfect image, photography, all of those things?
Yeah, it's really good. I don't think he realized it at first.
No.
I think that in 46, again, this really important early campaign, I don't think he had a full grasp of that. Though we should remember, his father had made lots of money in Hollywood. His father understood the importance of image building. He understood that a handsome candidate with a great war record, as JFK had, as his son had, could use those attributes to great effect. But I think JFK himself begins to realize this later. There's no question that in 52, this monster win against Henry Cabot Lodge Jr. In Massachusetts for a Senate seat. I think by now he's beginning to realize, we're entering a new age in which television is going to be much more important than it's been before. I'm pretty comfortable on the camera. I think I can use that to my purposes. And little by little, and this is something I'm going to be tracing in volume two as we get into the late 50s and as he's running for president. No question, Matthias, that now he says, in this age in which politics and entertainment, if you will, are beginning to merge, I can be successful here.
So it's interesting because, in a sense, then he also understands modernity, and that's what I take from Why England Slept. That he has a knack for it. He has an understanding of what's going on. But as you pointed out, and let's end on that note, he's at heart an historian. He loves history, and he really sees the world through a historical perspective at all times, it feels like. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's true. And I suppose I'll confess that it's another reason why I'm sympathetic to this man, because that love of history and that historical sensibility. Mm. And if you will, a belief, long before it's a phrase, his belief in the notion of applied history, I think is there. And there's lots of evidence for this. And, you know, we haven't discussed his fascination with his sort of desire to emulate Winston Churchill. But I think it speaks to this because I think he sees in Churchill somebody who's the same, who's incomparably more accomplished as compared to himself, and who's much more of a historian than he is. But on some level, he thinks, you know, Churchill is a kind of model for me, somebody who can combine this historical sensibility with an astonishing ability, in Churchill's case, of oratory and of being able to express important themes and ambitions in ways that register with people. I think, at least to a degree, he wants to follow in a similar path and believes, maybe more to the point, that history and an understanding of history, a sense of the vagaries of history, the degree to which it can outwit our certitudes, the degree to which history can have unintended consequences. I think that's something he grasps, and I think it gives him a certain perspective that I think will be important when he becomes president himself. Mm. I think it affects his policy decisions, not down the line, but I think there are certain key moments, including during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 62, when this historical mind manifests itself in a way that I think proved to be highly important.
So, in previous scholarship, we've seen John F. Kennedy described as Kennedy the hero, Kennedy the manipulative politician, and what some might call Kennedy the elusive president. So, Fred, is your Kennedy then Kennedy the applied historian?
Hmm. Well, he certainly is in part. In the book, I lay out some themes in the preface, as one often does, and I talk about the international sensibility. I think I could call it that, but it's really connected very much to this notion of history and this belief in history and his own place in history. I think he's conscious of this. I think it helps inform who he is. I think it gives him a sense that he's part of something great, and that in this American century of which he's a part, he can play a leading role, comes in part, again, from this reading of history and this broad understanding of it. I'm comfortable, Matthias, with that as at least partly my summation of who he is. I think the other possibilities you just articulated have power in them, too. There is there's more to this complicated figure than the notion of an applied historian. But it's part of who he is, no question.
Frederick Logevall, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
History Lessons is a podcast from the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.